Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and all over the world. It's the election next month, as you may have noticed, so we have the Green Party prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, Mr. Ricky Knight, here in the studio, and we've also got a returning guest. Eager-eared listeners may remember the name of Neil Maggs from the Respect Party. The Liberal Democrats have declined to telephone us or be a guest on the show. We did try and get Stephen Williams to telephone us, but that hasn't worked out, although we did make every effort to try and get them involved. Our features this week are by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Malcolm Grieve reads the second instalment of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. And Trevor Carter, as usual, our resident bard, reads his latest poem. Jeff Sparks is back in the studio for his What Song Guide and the Song of the Week. And last but not least, I'm John Peter Coleman, your presenter. So, over now to our studio guest, Ricky Knight, but let's hear a track from the Albion Band first, called Tomorrow's Too Late.
Hedges we've lost stretch three times round the earth. We've lost half of our wetlands, half of our trees. There's no meadow left for the birds and the bees. With motorways slicing their way through the scene, and pipelines so slick you can't see where they.
Within days of the fallout from Chernobyl drifting over Britain, all the samples from Cumbria exceeded the action level suggested for removing livestock from grazing out of doors. If an accident to a reactor over 1,000 miles away can wreak such havoc, then what would be the consequences if Sellafield were to go up?
Ricky Knight from the Green Party.
Hi, hello.
You're kind of wearing a rather clashing combination just because you're in lots of green sat on blue and it doesn't really work on radio, but you're wearing a t-shirt that says green, not greed.
Yes, that's about, I've got about 120 different t-shirts which sort of point out every stage of my political life and over the last 30, 40 years, yeah.
Okay, so how are you getting on pounding the streets of Bristol? You're standing in Bristol West, I understand,
yes.
Against
a lot of hills. A lot of hills, John, yes. Getting on very, very well indeed. I certainly do like knocking on the doors and the reaction and reception we get is very... It's very good. Very
you kissed
strong.
Any babies yet?
Made fatuous promises. No, it's frowned upon slightly, I think.
Right. Okay. I mean, what is your history in politics? Have you stood before?
Well, my history in politics, I've been a member of the Green Party for 30 years, but I only really got active after the invasion of Iraq in 2002. And I stood for local council and on an anti-war ticket, actually. And it was that denouement, that disgraceful, immoral, illegal invasion that made me say to myself, having been active in NGOs for such a long time, that I just, I thought I had to put up or shut up, you know. Whinging from the outside, to my mind, was not nearly as effective as trying to get it on the inside.
So what's made you switch from being a local councillor as such to being a parliamentary candidate? What do you think you can really offer, and what kind of changes do you hope to be able to make?
I do have ambitions, it's true. I don't know if it's ego-driven, but it's certainly driven altruistically by real fear of what this world heading for, which is an environmental catastrophe. It just happens to have coincided over the last 2 years with an economic disaster as well. I think the two go hand in hand. But no, I've made that journey. I was the lead candidate for the European elections last year, and the Greens were ever so close to getting their first representative in Brussels, or only 0.8% behind. And significantly, but not entirely happily, we decimated the Labour vote and beat the Labour Party by 25,000 votes. So I suppose I would say that proves that when people have a chance to vote proportionally, they do take it and vote Green.
Are you, I mean, there's talk that they may change to a proportionally representative system afterwards. I mean, are you generally in support of that?
I definitely would be. That would be my my wish. My greatest wish would be that if there's a hung parliament, and I'm officially not supposed to support this, but if there is a hung parliament, and it looks like this could well happen, that the major bargaining chip that Clegg offers Mr. Brown is for PR, has to be. I really am anxious as to what will happen if he goes the other way and forges an alliance with Mr. Cameron, because if that's the case, I can't see Cameron going for PR. It's too cosy for the Conservatives to maintain this first-past-the-post system.
Okay, I mean, specifically locally, I mean, what are your policies? What sort of a ticket, apart from obviously Green, are you standing on in the Bristol West constituency?
That's true. You're absolutely right. In terms of obviously Green, we are standing on three parts of policy in Bristol, namely a much better integrated transport system. Mm-hmm. We're looking towards renewable energy, a vast investment into green jobs and greening of the economy, as we call it, and very, very, very much into fighting any cuts in public services.
Okay. I mean, how do you feel about the fact that, honestly, the implementation of green policies is undoubtedly going to be affected by a downturn in spending and government spending? I mean, so do you think if you do get in, you're likely to be able to see any success in these policies being enacted?
Well, I must admit, I agree with you. If the Green Party doesn't have any input in Westminster, then I suspect that the environment will go even further down the list of priorities. Mm. Cameron's party, even if he has tried to pretend otherwise, have already made it clear that the environment is almost rock bottom in terms of their priorities. Spending cuts, I'm not into it, I'm afraid. I'm not that excited by the prospect of it. I'd much, much keener that we keep up the infrastructural investment. And we bailed out the banks to the tune of €3 trillion. The money is there somehow.
Okay. So, I mean, before I switch over to Neil, I might ask a guess. I mean, a lot of people may not be clear. Where exactly do you stand on the left-right agenda? People probably assume you're left-wing, socialist sort of sympathising party.
Well, I'm proud to say that I'm a socialist. I certainly come from a socialist background, but I don't think any party owns the word socialism any more than any party owns the word environmentalism. So I am a socialist, and particularly in terms of human rights, minority rights, and workers' rights.
Are
if
most
you like.
Of the Green Party of the same persuasion? Or?
I don't think they'd necessarily say they're socialist, but in terms of the political compass, if we were to analyse our policies, we'd probably end up on what's called the libertarian left. That's a fact of life, but with such a plethora of right-wing parties, I don't see that as a major problem. I think even the Labour, well, I think I know the Labour Party has veered to the right in government.
I'll pass over to Neil Maggs now from the Respect Party.
Hello there, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Not too bad.
You're not actually standing as a local candidate or prospective parliamentary candidate, so what is your involvement in the election?
No, it's... With the Respect Party, what we did, we had a kind of difficult decision to take back end of last year with the election looming as to, you know, do we stand in Bristol or do we actually look at the first-past-the-post electoral system that we have at the moment? Mm-hmm. And how do you actually make, as a relatively new and still relatively small party, how do you make a real impact? You know, how do you say, you know, hitting above your weight? And what we do with the one MP that we've got in George Galloway, we had a look round at where we've got other good strengths, and in particular Salma Yacoub, the party leader, who's standing in Birmingham. Yeah. And we had to take the decision, well, do we run lots of little campaigns, or do we actually throw our weight behind, you know, a handful of very good campaigns with the objective of maybe going to two MPs, three MPs, and building up our strength that way? What's come out, and Ricky referred to it in the, you know, just now, that the if there is some sort of Lib-Lab Pact or some other form of collusion, that over the course of the next year or two, we could be looking at a change in the voting structure, which is what Respect has been campaigning for more or less since the day that it started, that would then give us more of a chance of getting people elected in cities like Bristol. But at the moment, We did consider standing myself in Bristol South. We considered Jerry Hicks standing in your constituency, Ricky. The decision was made and the recommendation came from Respect nationally. Let's chuck all of our weight into the very few campaigns. So we've got, the objective is, with people from the Bristol area, we've been going up to Birmingham, I've been going up to Birmingham, we've got a coach load going up over the bank holiday weekend again, throwing all our weight behind Salma, and the real effort is to get a really good campaigning candidate, and somebody who's been an excellent councillor in Birmingham, elected to Westminster.
Okay, I mean, there are a lot of sort of socialist and left-wing groups, particularly seeing as Labour are commonly regarded as not being as left-wing as they were. I mean, what's wrong with, sort of, for example, the Socialist Working Party and other left-wing groups, and what's the difference between Respect and you and all the others? I mean,
virtually nothing. In Bristol South, I'm personally backing Tom Baldwin, who's standing on the Trade Union and Socialist Coalition.
Well, you say virtually, I mean, so what is the purpose of Respect existing in itself rather than sort of say,
there's a whole load of coalition. I mean, the original title was Respect the Unity Coalition, and that is exactly what we are. We are a coalition of many ideas and many ideals. Obviously, we started with the anti-war movement, but we're very environmental again. I mean, I'm nodding along during the questions you were asking Ricky just now. You know, I mean, I've got the Respect Manifesto, which has just been launched. I mean, one of the key points here, generating at least 40% of energy from renewable sources by 2020. You know, there's all sorts of reducing food poverty, creating green jobs. We're very much alongside all of them. The Socialist Worker Party, the Trade Union Socialist Coalition, we work alongside all of them. Whenever we come to non-political issues, any trade union issue, for instance, we've been supporting the postal workers in their dispute to keep Royal Mail in public hands and to stop the closure of post offices. And we go along there, and if they're on the picket line, we'll be members of the Trade Union Socialist Coalition, along with various trade unions, along with the Socialist Workers' Party and Respect Party there. We stand side by side, shoulder to shoulder, in the traditional socialist manner.
Okay, so, I mean, that doesn't sound... Is it not a possibility, therefore, you're encouraging people to join the Respect Party at the expense of other sort of socialist... sort of left-wing parties? I mean, I'm not quite sure, you know, what's the difference.
What's the difference between
Respect, there are a lot of parties covering the same ground.
What is the difference is that we're very much aimed at the political campaigning, which I outlined just now, of trying. We've got George as an MP.
Yeah.
We've got Salma, who
we think
will be...
Do you think other parties are lacking in that respect, possibly? Or?
I mean, you know, the one thing that we'll say about Ricky and the Green Party, we would dearly love to have a Green MP. And is it Caroline Lucas as in Brighton? Now, what's happened between our parties is that Respect declined to stand somebody in Brighton. The Green Party declined to stand somebody in... The Birmingham seat, Birmingham Hall Green, that Salma's standing. And we've got this amazing amount of cooperation that's going on. It really is going on. And we've had, in the last couple of months, several meetings of what's the coalition of the left in Bristol. And it's been absolutely fantastic. All the parties you talk about, and we're all pulling in the same direction, and we're all saying the same things.
Okay, Ricky, would you agree with that? You're all pulling in the same direction, really? How do you feel about what you said?
Well, in many respects, we're pulling in the same direction, yes. And the convention of the left pointed out the points of contact we have with the trade union movement, and particularly with regard, as I said before, our ideals and our principles of social justice. It's absolutely vital we don't let that ball drop, if you like, because in times of a crunch, and everyone says that's what we're going to get, the three main parties are trying to outvie the other with the savagery of their cuts. I think Jerry Hicks called it the axes of evil, all three of them. And that's what we have to fight, because it's a cornerstone of any sort of ethical attitude to those who are least well off and those who are most those who have been most hurt by the collapse of the financial system and unemployment are the ones who are being now it's being suggested that they suffer for the second time, as it were.
I mean, from a left-wing sort of perspective, I mean, does the Green Party forge a lot of connections with trade unionism per se in a manner that respect does?
Well, we have tried, it's true, but not just for the funding, but because we do want to point out that I've been a trade unionist for all my working life. I was a workplace representative, and I proudly uphold my trade union principles of solidarity, but that I don't look upon that as just belonging to the Labour Party. There is a real problem, however, with the skewing of the financing of the Labour Party through the trade union movement, which I'd like the government to address by simply introducing state funding.
One of the big things, Ricky, in the trade union movement last year, of course, was the Vestas dispute, which we were again very much, and Gerry Hicks, who you mentioned, has very much led the campaign down on the Isle of Wight. Now, Vestas, for those who don't know, it's they make wind turbines. And so we're talking about, you know, sustainable resources, energy generation, and the plant closed down and the works being exported abroad. And there was an appeal to the Labour government, and I actually got a letter from Ed Miliband saying, well, we don't mind if they shut down because we're not really environmental after all. That being basically what he said. But, you know, with the Green Party and with the Respect Party, with all the trade unionists, although there weren't many trade unionists in the Vestas work, they staged, you know, strikes, demonstrations outside. And you know, the talk was, well, we don't really need Vestas anymore. And literally a few days later, I was watching a documentary programme on Discovery Channel or something on renewable energy sources. Yeah. And it went down to Cornwall, and there was this great big wind farm down there with Vestas in big letters written over all the wind the wind turbines. So I thought, well, there you are, Ed Miliband. That's you told for a lie.
Okay,
well, I'm just going to say, in terms of manifesto, and sometimes manifesto promises come out completely aridly, simply because increasingly people just don't believe a word that's said. You can say whatever you like, when you can walk you can talk the talk, and outcomes are greenwash, but the important thing is action. If we had the chance to enact our policies, we would proudly maintain we intend to invest £44 billion into the creation of up to 1 million green jobs in renewable energy, waste management, transport systems. It's such an opportunity there.
On the basis that your presence in Parliament would sort of be like act as also a lobbying element, yes, to other parties' manifestos. I mean, you mentioned the term sort of greenwash. I mean, what kind of influence do you think the Green Party is successfully managing to have on the implementation of genuinely environmental policies by mainstream parties?
Turn that round slightly. I'd hate to think... what would happen if the Green Party wasn't there? I believe the Green Party was 25 years ahead of the other parties in terms of coming to terms with the oncoming environmental degradation of the planet. And we were there, if you like. And likewise, proof of that is the fact that Liberal Democrats, for instance, have just adopted our climate change policy of contraction and convergence, which is really difficult to explain, but I'll have a go if you ask me. But it's taken them all this time. It's been a mainstay of our the way we'd like to cure the problem of the inequities between the developing world and the developed world. But the greening of the economy has been with us for such a long time. Take us out of the equation, and I just can't bear to think what the other parties will do. I think they shut down on environmental issues because it's just ostrich-like. You know, the public actually don't want to think too much about how much it's going to hurt them if we've adopted the policies that we definitely need to do to reduce our CO2 emissions.
Neil Max, any sort of particular last words before we finish?
What you said is exactly right. You know that we've... if you go back sort of 40 years and the Green Party, well, you were the Ecology Party back then, and, you know, they were saying, well, look, what we're going to do when the oil runs out and we're polluting the planet too much, and, you know, patronising politicians and big businessmen would sort of pat them on the head, say, oh, you nice little environmentalist, yes, carry on with what you're doing. And then, you know, over the course of the last three or four decades, everybody, even in the last year or two of George W. Bush's presidency in the USA, he was talking about environmental issues, and he's the arch oil-made billionaire. You know, it's something that's been absolutely crucial, and we support the Green Party and what they've been saying.
Okay, fair play. Well, good luck in supporting Salma Yacoub in Birmingham. And Ricky Knight, just lastly, I mean, what can you offer people in Bristol West that Stephen Williams can't? Why should they vote for you?
Well, I certainly can offer them hope. It's a question of prioritising. As I intimated earlier, that I do not trust the Lib Dems anymore to deliver on their promises when they're wooing the electorate in an election campaign. What happens on May the 7th will be business as usual. Okay. And for all the promises about PR, I just throw the spanner in the works. Say he forges an alliance with the Conservatives, or say his bargaining chip is not accepted by Brown or by Cameron, then all those tactical voters will their hopes will have been dashed.
Okay, well, Ricky Knight and Neil Max, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Well, returning momentarily to Neil Mags, we are pleased to hear that respect is not just a political force, but also a cultural one. With supporters like Billy Bragg and so forth, I mean, it's bound to happen, I guess. So what else have you got for us?
Well, yes, you're absolutely right. It's the trade union movement has been great with its history of songs and music that, you know, back up the working class. And culturally with poetry as well. I mean, one of the great heroes of campaigners championing public transport was John Betjeman. Mm-hmm. And poet laureate, God bless his soul, sadly departed. And I never forget his famous poem, the Dilton Marsh Halt, the last verse of which goes, "When all the roads are exhausted and there's no more petrol to burn, to Dilton Marsh Halt, steam trains will return." A lovely one. Dilton Marsh Halt, if you've been there, it's near Trowbridge, and the platform's about 14 yards long. And you know, the idea of steam trains pulling in there, an absolute fantastic one. And in the spirit of Betjeman, with the election upon us as the Respect Party's, Bristol Respect Party's sitting poet, I've written an election poem, John.
Excellent.
Which, with your permission, I will now read. Okay. It's entitled, "We Must Decide."
Okay.
They say the people must decide between three parties we can't abide. New Labour, on Iraq they lied, 1 million dead, 10 million cried. Privatisation they've always denied, yet public services they divide, and broken promises we deride. MPs' expenses they tried to hide, whilst bankers took us for a ride. And now we're broke, the people sighed. Vote Tory if you're a millionaire, they'll look after you fair and square. Non-dom tax you don't declare to fund the Tory party fair. For working folk they just don't care, Tory and Lib the robbing pair. We'll cut our schools and hospitals bare, the heart from public service there tear. And pensioners you must beware, into an empty pot you'll stare. So I became a socialist, a ragged trousered philanthropist, a people first trade unionist. On decent pensions we insist, and we reject the racist. More council housing tops our list, and budget cuts we will resist, 100 jobs at the flick of a wrist. And we turn from the warmonger's fist to a world where we all coexist. It's a shame so few can select to vote for the party we call Respect. So tax the wealthy we expect, the national debt we could dissect, and close each loophole they detect. Energy, transport in public sect, and profligate bankers we reject. So people stand up, proud and erect, because one day we will elect, for justice, peace and hope, Respect!
Well, proper Bible-bashing stuff there, a bit of enthusiasm, it's just what we want on the radio. Excellent. Neil Max, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
Another track from the Albion Band now, and this time it's Why Have You Stolen Our Earth?
For years we've been greedy and blind, never noticed the damage that's caused by mankind, but now we are being taken to task. And there's one question all children ask.
Why have you stolen our earth?
Nobody told us how much it was worth. We want to make up for that now. And the children are showing us how.
Hedgerows and ditches have gone. You tell us that's progress, you had to move on. Instead, we've got mountains of wheat and icebergs of unwanted meat. The price paid for power can be high. Chernobyl showed you by clouding the sky, but power could be safe and be free. Use the sun and the wind and the sea. So why have you stolen our earth?
Nobody told us how much it was worth. We want to make up for that now, and the children are showing us how.
That was the Albion Band, and the track was called Why Have You Stolen Our Earth? Feature now from Tony Gosling. Although all the three main parties talk about going green, when you actually try and build your own green home, you'll find it almost impossible. Caroline Barry from Glastonbury did it though. She built her own straw-baled house, but found that she had to fit in with all sorts of strange and silly planning rules, like, for example, she had to move it every 3 weeks or so to stop the council pulling it down.
I could, with my house, I could move 13 times during a year to somebody else's house, and we could just keep that cycle going.
Well, maybe there's a case for groups of 13 people coming together to do this.
It would make a lot of sense to do that, without any doubt. Yes, it would.
And that's only basically to circumvent the planning restrictions, is it?
Yes, absolutely.
Because and what do you think of those rules? I mean, it doesn't sound all that sensible. What is the point of having a rule that says that you can only spend 28 days there?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I think it's a bit archaic. It's about time it got changed. And to be perfectly honest, that the planning departments need to recognise that there are groups of people like myself who wish to live on the land that will not interfere with anything to anybody else. I mean, for instance, my planning permission is now a permanent permission for a temporary house for my lifetime. And when I die, the house needs to come down. If a member of my family cared to take it on, well, then they have to apply for planning permission in the same way. So the cycle could continue, or else planning department can turn around and decide that's enough, we've got rid of her, let her go, and that's the end of that.
It does seem rather bizarre when we're living in a country which is a desperate need for housing, that you are only allowed this house for your own lifetime and then it has to come down. That just seems completely crazy.
Yeah, it is. It is, unfortunately. And with the housing shortage that we've got, I mean, after the last war, the council's put up prefab houses. Now, in actual fact, because of the housing shortage we've got now, they could do the same thing again. I mean, you can always import a log cabin, which is a kit, put it together and use it as a house. And you could put it up on foundations like I have on car tyres, so you're not laying it on the earth in any way. And they could use them as prefab houses and solve the housing crisis.
So why do you think they don't do that?
Oh, because they haven't even thought of that. They're intent on building. I mean, you find now that you've got developers that build big housing estates, and the houses that they don't sell are the 4 and 5 bedrooms. 2 and 3 bedrooms sell very easily, and then they've still got 4 or 5 bedrooms waiting, and then you've got the next developer coming along to build more houses. Well, I'm sorry, but in this economic climate, we can't afford that type of house. You know, they have to think on more reasonable grounds.
So do you think there's any chance of local authorities building more houses like this, or are they stuck in the role of kind of cooperating with the big housing developers who, of course, are building less and less now?
I'd like to say that in West Dorset, we've got an estate planning for 10 strawberry houses going up, which the district council will actually own, and then local people can buy. And they are maintaining the prices that they won't ever go onto the open market.
Because this is another problem, isn't it? You've got a lot of wealthy Londoners and people from the city buying up second homes in the country.
Yeah, they do that. And unfortunately, what it does is to push the prices up further and further. And the problem we've had over the recent years is that estate agents need to make money. So the higher the price house prices are, then, of course, they get more commission on that house. So, I mean, it is possible for district councils to build something like strawberry houses estates and put up energy efficient houses, which would be brilliant. And I think there's an estate going up in Lincolnshire as well. So, I mean, the council are changing their views, but it takes, I mean, it's a hell of a tide to do that. And it takes a long time to get through. And unless or until we actually get the one in Lincolnshire and the one in West Dorset put up and prove that they work and how cheap they can be and how energy efficient they are, then it'll take a long time until planning departments actually look at that. And of course, developers, when they buy a piece of land, they want to make money. So the more expensive the houses are, then that suits them, doesn't it?
Well, let's hope that at least some councils around the country, because we hear that Gordon Brown is going to be building council houses again for the first time since the Thatcher years, look at these examples.
That would be brilliant if he'll do that, and if he would actually look to alternative building, not necessarily straw bale, but maybe log or timber or something, then there are other methods of building, and they would be a lot healthier for the people that are living in there because it would be without the toxins.
Thank you to Caroline Barry for agreeing to talk to us there. She built her own straw bale home in Butley near Glastonbury and found out just how difficult it is when you want to actually live a real green lifestyle. Our next feature is from Anthea Page, following on from our green theme. It's about a rare breed pigs. It's an interview with Shane Phillips. But first of all, in the pigs theme, Pink Floyd track called Pigs on the Wing.
From pigs on the wing.
My name's Shane Phillips.
And do you breed pigs?
I don't breed pigs at the moment. I have insufficient funds to be able to back myself to get sow, boar and breed a herd up like that. At the moment, all I do is I bring pigs on from weaner at usually about 8 weeks old up to chop time at around about 6 months old. Tamworth pig originated about 150 to 200 years ago, I believe, and originally they were not the ginger colour that we see today. They were spotty and brown and I'm not quite sure what other colour they had spotted in them, but they've been bred through today that they are more or less a pure ginger stroke Auburn breed of pig. Prick-eared, and they are considered to be the royalty of pigs. The bacon and...
Don't say that in front of the pig, please.
Sorry. The meat that is produced by these pigs, dual meat, re, the B word and the P word, is considered to be of superb quality. Several years ago now, Bristol University did a study of people and Tamworth came out right on top. In fact, it was considered so much better than any other pork that it was considered worthy of doing a further survey or scientific study to find out why their pork was so superior.
These are fantastic looking pigs. They look like a cross between a pig and a fox.
They do look a little of that sort of thing. Of course, most people's idea of a pig nowadays is what they perhaps see in an intensively reared pen, where we see the white breeds of pigs that have been bred to stretch them in the back slightly longer. Some breeds actually have one more rib than is normal in a pig, so that you get one more chop or a little bit more of the B word. These are rare breed pigs, and I believe there are only in the hundreds of breeding sows of the Tamworth breed left in the country. But there are quite a few enthusiasts of rare breed pigs, and you know, they're not quite allowed to die out quite as easily nowadays as they were 35-40 years ago.
I think the most interesting thing is they've got more hair.
The reason behind that is whilst my pigs do have some straw in their beds, they are outside pigs and they're a little bit devious in the way they live, that if it's a bit on the chilly side outside, they grow a bit more by way of hair.
What are these?
They are principally saddleback, but I think, although there's nothing other than what they call prick ears visible on these are principally saddleback, and I think they've got maybe a little bit of Durox cross in them, and I'm not quite sure what the other cross is. The litter they came from was a whole variety of colours and what have you, and some looked a bit Tamworthy, which is the Durox, I believe, in them. The giveaway on these, that they're not a straight saddleback pig, and the saddleback is the fact they've got the white stripe around their shoulders. The giveaway is they've got what they call prick ears. Normally a saddleback pig's ears come down over its eyes, and lots of farmers that bred and still breed them and what have you, are they quite like their saddleback breed because they claim that they can't see too much because they're a bit blinkered because their ears come right down over their eyes. But the giveaway that these aren't straight saddlebacks is the fact their ears are what they call prick-eared and they can see sort of pretty much all the way round.
They've got a lot of hair on them, haven't
yes,
they?
Yes, yeah, they're very, very black and black and white.
Almost like a badger.
Yeah, the stripe goes the wrong way for a badger though, doesn't it? Yeah. They've got a white stripe, pinkish stripe right away over their forequarters on the saddle area if they were a horse, right the way over. The rest of them is almost jet black. I do me two pigs every 4 months. And I can manage to live on some really good quality pork.
Do you make sausages yourself?
I make sausages, I make faggots, I cut my own joints, and I was very disappointed the last time that I parted company with a pig that I had to go to work on the day that it was slaughtered, and unfortunately I couldn't do my own black pudding, but that is next on the list.
So do you go with them to the abattoir?
I take them into the abattoir. If I'd been making black pudding, I would have been as close as possible to collect the blood when they were knocked down, and I would have been there whilst this was occurring.
Do you feel sad about seeing your pig killed?
Pigs, like lots of animals, do have character. And if they've got a pretty unsavoury character that they run away from you when you come in to feed them, I must say that I'm fairly indifferent to them. I don't know why. My first two pigs that I had in this run here, you could come in here and play football with the little perishers. They were absolutely brilliant. But these two here, if I walk up to them, they'll just go woof and run a mile. Previous two that I had killed, one of them had tried to bite me, and therefore I was looking forward to bacon and sausages. I really was.
Do you actually see them being killed?
I haven't seen any of my own pigs being killed, but as a nipper in the 60s, my mother used to go and buy our Sunday joint at the local abattoir, which had a butchery shop right beside it, and as a bloodthirsty little 10, 11-year-old, I was always peeping through the door. So it's one of those sad facts of life that I've seen it, and it doesn't particularly bother me.
And how did they used to do it in those days?
Exactly the same as they do it nowadays. Pigs and lambs, electric shock over the ears, and then throat cut.
What are weaners?
Weaner is a piglet that's just come from its mum to being able to feed and fend for itself in a run and live its own sort of life in my free-range pen.
And where do you get the weaners from?
I've got a bit of a source that I can buy my saddlebacks from a farm called Modbury Farm over near Burton Bradstock. My Tamworths came in from a chap in Horton. The youngest Tamworth came in from a farm shop or farmer up in Long Burton, and the last two there have just come in from Hewood Farm up at Sadborough.
So do you think more farmers are turning to these rare breeds?
Rare breeds and commercialism don't work too desperately well because you need to have a little bit more by way of time to bring them on. They don't work too desperately well under too much by way of a tight penned situation. The other thing is that rare breed pigs tend to have slightly different flavourings than the ones that are intensively reared. The other reason why my pigs have a different flavour to their pork is the fact that they are as free range as I can make them. They're out here rooting all day, which is what pigs do naturally. You'll pick a weaner up from a person that's produced it on a concrete pen. Out here on this sort of pen, they come in, they'd be here about 15 seconds inside the run, and it's really nice sight that the first thing you see is nose in the ground and pig is happy. He's rooting.
Is there enough food actually in this enclosure then to feed them?
No, I do feed them on a normal pig nut, but as far as I'm aware, the principal ingredient is wheat and barley. Pigs are actually the ultimate recycler. They can eat meat and they can eat vegetation. Unfortunately, somebody on the last foot and mouth disease fouled this up, that they'd fed swill feed to their pigs. It was hanging about too long or hadn't been cooked properly, and we've got a foot and mouth disease that was attributed to a swine herd, and the government in its infinite wisdom has stopped you from feeding leftover scraps to pigs. I cannot feed my pigs anything that has gone through a kitchen process, even mine. I'm not allowed to do it. If DEFRA come down here and look around my pig trough and they can see that I've got some there, then I get my holding licence pulled. And I can't afford to do that, so I just stick by the rules.
Will you be breeding these eventually?
My family are very, very keen that I should have one or two sows and a boar, that we have got our own piglets. I'm looking to try and have my herd, if I have a herd myself, I'm looking to do just straight Tamworths.
How much does it cost to keep a pig?
Generally, I buy my pigs in at around about £35 a pig. And they will cost you somewhere in the region of £35 to £45 each pig in pig nuts for the 4 month period that you're bringing them on to death. It'll then cost you, unless you sell them straight to a slaughterhouse where they sell them to butchers, which I consider to be a waste of rare breed pig, because most butchers just take in pork and it's just pork and not rare breed. So I tend to pay the slaughtering costs myself. A local abattoir is £20 a pig, slaughtered and cut down the middle. You are allowed to kill your own animal for your own consumption. The law is that you are only allowed to kill and eat yourself. From what I can gather, you're not actually allowed to even feed your family on what you've killed. So, bit of a pointless exercise. So I just
sounds very Anglo-Saxon, that.
Well, yes, I suppose it is. Yes.
Thank you very much to Anthony Page and Shane Phillips there. Malcolm Grieve reads this week's instalment of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell.
Secrets and Lies, unearthed by David Southwell. From the hidden facts about fraudulent election results and illicit campaign donations, to lies over secret drug use and weapons of mass destruction, when you study it, the history of politics is a history of lies. Politicians are the least trusted group of people, according to research, and with good reason. Just look at the lies they tell and secrets they cover up in their climb to and exercise of power. Politicians lie to keep their jobs and to further their own personal as well as political ambition. To them, truth is rare, though it's a word they often use when trying to convince us that they have the answer to our problems. None of this should surprise us, but we seem apathetic when it comes to challenging this sorry state of affairs. Even when we learn some of their shocking secrets or the worst of their lies are exposed, the most we seem to do in response is change where we put our X at the next election. Unless the public becomes better at demanding higher standards of truth, our politicians may continue to treat us with contempt through secretive policies designed to keep us purposefully ignorant. When Alistair Campbell was Tony Blair's Director of Communications, many informed observers nicknamed him the Co-Prime Minister. But no one was joking when they called him the second most powerful man in the British government. Campbell was a writer of pornographic stories under the pseudonym the Riviera Gigolo before becoming the political correspondent of the Daily Mirror. With a self-confessed drink problem and suffering from a nervous breakdown, Campbell managed to get his life back on track with the help of former Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock. Campbell went on to become Blair's closest advisor and instrumental in his rise to power. The role of Campbell in manipulating the presentation of intelligence in dossiers that formed the basis for the UK's role in the invasion of Iraq is well known and much discussed. However, another alleged example of misrepresentation of information involving Campbell dates from the US and UK war in Afghanistan. The London Coalition Information Centre he was involved with were behind reports that British soldiers found evidence in a cave that Al-Qaeda terrorists had built a biological and chemical weapon laboratory. The reports were later contradicted by senior military officers, as were claims made by a Blair spokesman that the Baghdad regime was supplying Osama bin Laden's terrorists with chemical and biological weapons. Even after leaving his job, Campbell remained a close advisor to Prime Minister Blair and retained his reputation as the ultimate dark prince of spin, a word that detractors have suggested has become a euphemism for outright lying. Whilst most spin doctors see their role as advocates of the individuals, organisations and ideas they are representing, some would say an internal ethical code prevents many of them from bullying journalists or presenting the truth in ways Campbell has specialised in. Others just say he's the best at doing what a spin doctor needs to do. When Campbell was having his routine MI5 security vetting interview, he was asked the standard question: have you ever knowingly divulged, or can you imagine any circumstances in which you would do so, sensitive or classified information to unauthorised sources? Journalist Sion Simon was able to report that, with a look of disgust on his face, Campbell replied with the impatient brevity that is his trademark, "That's my f***ing job." US presidential debates have been described as a televised interview for the job of the most powerful person on the planet. The impact of the debates on the candidates' chances in the presidential elections cannot be underestimated, nor can the image of the debates being beamed across the globe as a symbol of American democracy. In Great Britain, campaigns to have debates introduced on the grounds that they play an essential role in informed voter choice have been successful. Campaigners argued that, although there may be problems counting the votes cast in a US election, the debates are a beacon of free speech, open political discussion, and public accessibility to the candidates. However, the truth is that the debates are not open, accessible arenas of free speech. They are secretly regulated by the Republican and Democratic parties through a private bipartisan corporation called the Commission on Presidential Debates, the CPD. In 1992, the CPD, jointly run by former heads of both parties and funded by big US corporations, took control of the debates that had previously been run by the non-partisan League of Women Voters. Every 4 years, they negotiate a secret document called the Memoranda of Understanding, which dictates precisely how the debates will be structured and televised. The CPD control of the debates allows them to exclude third-party candidates, even those like Ross Perot, who took 19% of the popular vote when he stood in 1992. The 2005 Memoranda of Understanding ran to 34 pages and contained clauses such as no follow-up questions by the moderator will be permitted, and no cross-questionings by the candidates or cross-conversation between the candidates will be allowed. No wonder they became as dull as ditch water. Alan Keyes, a former Republican presidential candidate, said, "If you are going to present a partisan brawl in which you have excluded anybody but your chosen few, I would say, just do it. You have the right to do it. It's a free country. Don't pretend, however, to do it under a rubric of non-partisanship. Just don't pretend it's non-partisan or not controlled. That's cheating. That's corruption. That's lying. That's an effort to manipulate the perception of the voters in order to favour your power."
Thank you very much to Malcolm Greaves there for that excellent last reading of Secrets and Lies. And now let's hear from our resident bard, Mr. Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and of course of Daleks Radio. Trevor, hello.
Hi there, John.
Have you had a good week?
No, because I haven't been very well, which is why I wasn't here last week.
Okay. Did your illness make you sort of introspective in a way and produce more poetry?
Well, yeah, I'm always writing, yeah. I've been thinking a lot about bricks.
Right.
But that's not what I'm going to talk about tonight.
Okay.
Because, as we know, there are only days left for the great event, you know. Mm-hmm. So, I kind of think, well, what's going through the mind of our glorious leader at this critical time in our history? And this is an insight into, well, speculation, one could say, is what is going through the mind of the glorious leader. It's called The Ballad of Notta-Lotta. High aloof squats Notta-Lotta, all around him is unhappy. Denounce all slippy Tory rotter, Gordon he be grumpy chappy. Economy it go to meltdown, but keep the best jobs for the boys. The squaws are best for window dressing, flinty bits of silly toys. Notta-Lotta he know best for keeping everybody down. What is everyone upset for? Notta-Lotta's not a clown. Notta-Lotta he is wise one, understand long-term division. He is chappy with his eyes on messy complex indecision. A big Chief Cameron no listen, thinks Notta-Lotta is a fool. Like a mad dog twicely bitten, he snarly at Notta-Lotta's rule. A big Chief Clegg he much bad naughty, say everything a heap big mess. Say we need a proper sortie, big Chief Clegg he bad assess. Also there be UKIP party, crazy men from far off right, say to end the Euro party, should be lock up very tight. Whingy do-good greeny hippies, obsess about environment, weedy bunch of skinny dippies, boggly-eyed on flowery scent. BNP is even more bad, stirry up big racial fuss. This make Notta-Lotta more mad. Stupid whites should vote for us. Media wallers spread false rumour. I bully boy, now Roma grows. If I find who start this rumour, I big punch him in the nose. Notta-Lotta very troubled, but ego big, he carry on. A tinker with the crumbly rule book. Notta-Lotta not yet gone. But Notta-Lotta very angry, Notta-Lotta patience now. End expenses, hanky-panky, flippy home games, holy cow! Listen up to Minnie Harmon, bestest score in all the land. She be loyal to Notta-Lotta, sit at Lotta's lefty hand. Snake Man Mandy, bestest helper, make the people see what's best. Stop the slippy helter-skelter, make the people's help the quest. Best no speak or think too clearly, best a turvy-topsy front. Best do not say too much really, people's no like leader blunt. Best to keep up repetition, use a heap of hot air breath. Repeat a lot, big jumbly numbers, numb the people's half to death. Keep repeating, things get better. Other chiefs are just a curse. Repeat a lot, big jumbly numbers. They forget I make them worse. They forget I print much wonga. Keep economy afloat. Make the country short-term stronger. Forget the big hole in the boat. Many billions give to bankers. Need to keep the rich on side. Poor ones only squander chances. They accept the rubbish ride. Best make up more legislation. Keep the peoples wrapped in rules. Inhibit the imagination. Need to make compliant fools. 13 years, still not enough time. Still can do more damage yet. Peoples can survive more tough time. Peoples all need healthy sweat. Must prepare for big election. Put many peoples in bad mood. Many peoples make defection. Many peoples think I'm screwed. All the peoples need to calm down. Notta-Lotta, best man, right? Clunky fist will put the rest down. I must work hard to win the fight.
Thank you very much to Trevor Castle, the Bard of Wimmer Hill on Dalek Radio. And in case you heard any giggles, that was Anthea Page, our producer in the background.
Thank you, John.
Well, time for our very own Big Chief Jeff, the man in black, and he's here to tell us what's on in Bristol. Hello.
Hello, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Wednesday, 5th of May, Gibo will be performing with support from The Operation at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance. On Thursday, 6th of May, Sound of Guns will be performing with support from Parrington Jackson at Moles Club, which is at 14 George Street, Bath. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £6 in advance and £8 on the door. On to Friday, 7th of May, The Communicators will be performing at The Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance. On to Song of the Week and our feature, The Rolling Stones. This is from the Beggar's Banquet album, which was released in December 1968, and is a song titled Dear Doctor.
Oh, help me, please, Doctor, I'm damaged. There's a pain where there once was a heart. It's sleeping, it's a baiting. Can't you please tear it out and preserve it right there in that jar?
That was The Rolling Stones with Dear Doctor from the album Beggar's Banquet. For more information, you can check out www.rollingstones.com. Moving on to Saturday, 8th of May, The Beat will be performing at the Thekla, which is at The Grove in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £15 in advance. Into Sunday, 9th of May, Mad Sin will be performing with support from Las Pistolas and also the Graveyard Johnnies at the Croft in Stoatscroft, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. Finally, on 9th of May, Kill Hannah will be performing with support from My Passion at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £11 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Well, that's it. It's the end of the show. Time flies fast. Studio guests were Ricky Knights, the Green Party prospective parliamentary candidate for Bristol West, and we had Neil Maggs from the Respect Party. Good luck to them both in their respective endeavours. Malcolm Greave read the second episode of Secrets and Lies by David Southwell, and the features are by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Poem was by Trevor Carter, the Bard of Wimble Hill and Dialect Radio, and the Watson was by Jeff Sparks. The studio engineer was Johnny Royden, and the producer was Anthea Page. It's goodbye from myself, John Peters Coleman, the presenter of this week's Dialect Radio. Until next week, goodbye.